G'day you mob, welcome to this episode of Aussie English. Today it is a special interview episode where I am interviewing my dear friend David Rajaraman, who is of Indian descent. He grew up in Brunei. He then came to Australia and studied aeronautics at university up in Queensland. He then ended up in Japan teaching English. He speaks four languages and he's just had an incredible life. And the guy's only in his mid-30s. So absolutely incredible guest. I was so pleased when he agreed to come on the podcast and share his thoughts about growing up globally as a global citizen, learning multiple languages, his sense of identity. And then also, this one is for the Japanese fans of the podcast, because I wanted to get someone who hadn't grown up in Japan, but was living there and was learning the language and had dived into the culture. I was wanting to get someone like that to come on the podcast and, as an outsider, be able to compare both Japanese and Australian culture to one another. So, without any further ado, guys, smack the bird. Let's get into it. So I've been practicing something. Ohayo gozaimasu.
Whoa. Nailed it, dude.
And then what have I got to say? Watashi no yujin.
Uh-huh.
Nailed it.
good morning. Good morning, my friend. Yeah.
Is that correct? Or is that Google correct, where you go and search this stuff and have no idea of what the actual grammar is?
That's Google correct.
I knew it. Oh, man. All right. So, let me introduce you. David Rajaraman. I met you recently. Well, recently. I've been following you for a few years now on Instagram and all of the social media stuff. And you are of Indian descent, came to Australia, and then later on moved to Japan, was teaching English in Japan. And now, I think most recently, you were telling me you've become a mechanic or working for a car company.
Yeah, that's right.
So, for obvious reasons, you have an incredibly interesting story to tell. And I also wanted to do something related to Japan, as Japan is one of the countries that download the podcast the most. So, I thought it would be really cool today to chat to you about your experience, obviously, growing up of Indian descent. You got educated in Australia and then moving to Japan, and what that sort of whole experience was like, and a little bit about identity. You know, do you see yourself as Indian, Australian, as a global citizen? And then maybe a little bit about cultural differences between Japan and Australia. So, how did you get here? To start there, how did you get here?
To Australia. Okay. So, I'm Indian, that's right, but I was born and raised in Brunei,
yep.
A tiny little country in Southeast Asia. And the norm in Brunei for anyone who's a foreigner would be to go abroad for university. Brunei had like one university, which was run by the government. My dad used to work there. He was a lecturer. But because Brunei was just this tiny little country in the middle of nowhere, almost, a lot of their degrees aren't internationally recognized.
Yeah.
So if you're planning to stay in Brunei and work there, then it's fine to go to university there. But if you plan to get a degree that's going to open up opportunities all over the world, you typically go somewhere else. And if you want to do your university education in English, then your options are going to be Australia, the UK, Canada, New Zealand, and the United States, right? And Australia at the time, this was 2005, 2006, or 2005 when I was applying for admissions.
This sounds like you're about my age. Are you 34,
35? I'm 33. Born in 87.
So I think
we are about the same. Oh, okay, yeah, so we're about the same age.
I was wondering, because I'm like, 2005, that was when I finished high school and was applying for universities as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Which month in 87 are you?
April. So, I just turned 34.
Oh, happy birthday, man.
Oh, thank you. How did you know? Awesome.
That's cool. So, yeah, in 2005 was when I was applying and going back and forth with my dad about where to go, which university to pick. Australia was like the most attractive option at the time. With the exchange rate the way it was at the time, and also where Australia is located, how diverse it is culturally in a lot of the major cities, it just made sense. It was more affordable. We had less of a time difference between Brunei and Australia, so we picked that, and I ended up going to Griffith University in Brisbane.
Yep. So, what language or languages were you raised to speak when you were in Brunei?
I'd say English was probably my first language, like all the way through. We did speak Tamil at home, which is my mother tongue, but you know, that's all it was. I just spoke it at home. I never studied it. Never got to an academic level. So even today, I can't use Tamil, let's say, in a formal business context. Yeah. I wouldn't be able to deliver a speech at a wedding or something like that in Tamil.
It sounds like my Portuguese. Well, it's a similar sort of thing. I use it in the home, but I don't really use it for any sort of professional related area or anything like that. So it is funny how you can obviously have a mother tongue from your parents that you're raised to speak at home, which is, I think, the case more and more now for as people that are born in Australia with migrant parents. They tend to learn the language, but they never get to the same level as their parents because they never end up using it that way. It's a communication amongst family members, but not an actual language for education or for business or anything like that. Usually, it's just English straight away.
Exactly. So, there is its own unique script. I can't read I can read it, but the other weird thing about Tamil is the written form of the language is as different to the spoken form as like Shakespeare in modern English. So even the grammar is different. The pronunciation is different.
Right.
So like, and I can't use the written form of it.
Wow. I'm looking it up now on Google. It is one of those very, very beautiful, curvy kind of writing systems, right?
Yeah. It is phonetic, so it's pretty easy to learn how to write, how to read it.
Yep.
So you can just like sound off anything, and if you know the word, you can sound it off and write it. Problem is that if all you know is spoken Tamil and you write things exactly the way you speak, you'll be, you know, raising a few eyebrows and people actually read your work.
Well, it's so interesting how that tends to happen with most languages, I think, right? That there'll be a it may differ to varying degrees, but you know, like if I were to try and write a formal speech in Portuguese with the Portuguese that I know, I would sound like an idiot or someone who is being very informal, because that's the only part of the language I really use. I haven't practiced any of the other stuff, but it's always really interesting to see the divergence between the two. And I'm sure English still has that kind of thing where you would, you know, if you're writing a formal email, to whom it may concern, when would you ever use that in spoken English, right? But for whatever reason, we use that to be polite in writing. So, it's always really interesting to see how these things differ. But it differs a lot in Tamil, huh?
Yeah, it's like a totally different language almost. It is still used. Obviously, it's used in schools and academics and on the news. So, if you turn on the news in India or even in like Malaysia where they've got Tamil news channels, the way that they're speaking and delivering the news would be totally different to how they would speak day to day. And, so there's that. And then there's Malay, which is the national language of Brunei. I took that as a subject, but all my other subjects in school were taught in English. And, you know, Brunei being a little bit of a melting pot, you know, I had like half of the students in any given classroom, would be non-locals or would be expats or foreigners from various parts of Asia, and our common language was English.
So, is that similar to Indonesian, where you will say things like pagi for like good morning and malam for evening?
It is the same language and a different dialect, you could say.
Yeah. Crazy.
So
you were learning those, and I think you speak a fourth language, right?
Japanese now, because I live here in Japan and I work here, so yeah.
Far out. So yeah, I don't know where to go from this area. What was it like when you came to Australia from Brunei? Were things a massive shock? Was there a lot of culture shock, or had you sort of grown up a pretty international kind of young kid who had a good idea of what Western countries were like or what Australia was like?
I think I didn't have too much of a shock because, first of all, I think Australia is very similar to what I would imagine a Western country to be like, you know, just from everything I was fed through the media. Obviously everybody spoke English. People are polite and friendly, even out in public. And they all have Australian accents, which is probably the only kind of surprise, or not surprise, but the only thing that's different to
what I was fed in the media. Huh? You had to get used to it.
but the cool thing is that I went in my, I think it was an upper secondary and through my A-levels or like high school.
Yep.
I went to an international school where a lot of the teachers were Australian.
Oh, brilliant.
And so we, you know, even before going to Australia, I did get like a little bit of a preview into, you know, the Australian accent and Australian slang terms and things like that, and a little bit about the culture and the food and things. So, yeah.
So what was it like when you stepped off the plane and, you know, set up shop at Griffith University and were sort of settling in? Did it take long to sort of feel it at home? Did you ever feel at home, or what was that experience like?
Dude, I felt home instantly. Like, it just felt like I had more people who were like my teachers, like my high school teachers around me, all at once. And also the fact that, you know, it's a university campus where, and Australia, you know, one of Australia's biggest exports I heard is their tertiary education.
100%.
You have huge revenue from international students. So, you know, being on campus, I've met other people. I actually bumped into some other people from Brunei, just like randomly.
Yeah.
I just randomly bumped into people who were from my school.
Oh, wow. Okay. And, wow. That's a little different from just my country, right?
yeah. And not only that, there's this one kid. He wasn't a kid then, but he used to sit next to me in grade 3. And we were friends. And I think it was after grade 3, I moved to a different school from grade 4 onwards. And so we, you know, at grade 3, you're not like, we didn't have mobile phones. We were in keeping contact. He just used to sit next to me, and that's all I knew about him.
Well, grade 3, what would that have been? Like 96, right? Like a long time ago, before the internet almost.
yeah. So I just randomly bump into this guy on my university campus.
Wow.
And I recognize him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went, and he kind of looked at me funny when we made eye contact. And then I just stopped and I was like, are you him? And I said his name. And he goes, yeah. And then he says my name. He goes, I was like, dude, what are you doing here? And we, you know.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to say something like, oh, man, I always hated you.
Yeah. So that was cool. That was real cool.
It's, I guess that's literally, you know, the meaning behind the expression, it's a small world.
Yeah.
You were like, I've moved to the other side of the planet and I'm still bumping into people I know.
Yeah. That was cool. And I still had like, tons of my other friends from some of my classmates who were at University of Queensland. So, you know, we were still in the same city, and we were able to meet up and hang out, you know, on the weekends and things like that. So, didn't take long for me to feel at home at all.
Well, Queensland often gets a bad rap as being an incredibly racist part of Australia. And you know, that Australia too tends to get a bad rap at times, being considered a very racist place. But I'm always interested to hear about this from the perspective of people who've chosen to come to Australia who are of different races or different backgrounds. Because on the one hand, we see in the media a lot about all these sorts of stories about racism. But on the other hand, you see people voting with their feet to come to Australia and want to live in Australia and you know, making a go of it and everything. Did you ever experience, you know, a significant amount of racism or anything like that up in Queensland or in Australia as a whole? Was it different from anywhere else in the world, or is that just sort of, is it sort of a stereotype that we latch onto a little bit?
I was in Australia for 6 years, and not once did I experience any kind of explicit racism.
Yeah.
And there was one thing that happened. It was just that once, or, you know, in that period of 6 years. And I would suspect that it was racism, but I can't, it's not something that I can know for sure. However, I did have this one housemate. He was from China. And he was studying at the same university. He was an accounting student. He said, you know, I know for a fact that he's been at the target of possibly racist attack because he'd ride his bicycle to university. And there's been a couple of times where like just this random car would kind of slow down next to him as he's riding and have eggs thrown at him.
Jesus.
And then also there's been times where he's had, you know, racist insults, you know, thrown at him just again from some random stranger in a car while he's riding his bicycle.
Yeah.
So like I've heard of that sort of thing happening. It's never happened to me. And at the same time, I think just based on my observations, when some sort of a racist, altercation occurs, and it's being reported in the media, I think like a big deal is made out of it by the media because it's a juicy story, mm-hmm. right? And I don't blame him. I think comparing the narrative about racism in the media when things like that happen and, you know, comparing that to my experience over 6 years, I definitely think there's a disconnect. I think it is exaggerated in the media and it's not reflective of what I actually saw.
It's funny how often that happens, though, with the media, right? I think there was another example of America and worrying about rape on campus, you know, and people would, there's stories of like 1 in 4 women are raped and you kind of like, well, why are there so many women still going to university? This sounds like it's the most dangerous place in the world to be a woman. So if these statistics were true, why on earth is anyone sending their children to a university if they have daughters? So it was really funny that the media was like, you know, massively spinning things. But back to Australia, did you get to travel around much and see much of the country whilst you were here for as long as you were?
Yeah, the weird thing is, you know, when I was there, I never actually traveled because I chose to. It'd usually be because
you got forced.
Usually be because one of my friends, you know, who's into that habit of, you know, going somewhere on holiday when we get like a long break or something, would invite me to go along with him. And so I've been to where was it? It's someplace in near Melbourne. Blue Mountains. They're called the Blue Mountains. They've got ski resorts and stuff there.
Near Sydney.
Near. Okay. So it's not near Melbourne.
It's about an 11-hour drive.
But no, that's right. Okay. So I say it's near Melbourne because we actually flew to Melbourne, rented cars, and then drove from there to the Blue Mountains. Or no, was it the other way around? I think we flew to Sydney, drove there from the Blue Mountains, and then drove to Melbourne and flew back to Brisbane. So it's this really cool trip. So I went there, been to Byron Bay a few times, which is, just over the border in New South Wales, coming from Queensland. And that's about it. I never went to Ayers Rock, which is like the absolute must go place if you're a tourist in Australia.
Man, I've never been there. I want to go there, but I've never been.
I heard you can't go there anymore, or you can't climb the rock.
Oh, you
anymore.
Can't climb it. No. So the local Indigenous people closed that down because it was a massive sort of disrespect thing where they see the rock as very, you know, holy and religiously significant. And so, you know, for decades have been saying, don't climb it. You're effectively scarring it because it had, you know, metal poles shoved in the side of it so people could climb up on it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, for a long time, but I think that was October of 2019, I think that they finally closed it down. But yeah, my dad's been to the top. He climbed it, but he was sort of, he had to because he went there as a school teacher. And all of the students, you know, wanted to go up there. So he had to, and he was like, it's screwed up. You go to the top of Ayers Rock and you're kind of like, the only thing I'm here to see is Ayers Rock. And I'm on top of it. It's the one thing I can't see. So, what the hell? And it's such an arduous climb. It's like hundreds of meters high. You don't realize. And the climb to get up it, at least initially, because it's shaped like a loaf of bread, right? You know, the sides are really, really steep. And so, it's like 45 degrees. You know, of an angle that you got to climb up with a chain and everything. people have died on it because they have heart attacks climbing up. I think it's like, you know, 6 people have died in history or something just climbing up it and getting heat stroke and having a heart attack. So, anyway, yeah, that's closed down. If you want to do that sort of thing, you want to see the top of Ayers Rock, get a pay $50 or whatever it is to get on the helicopter and just fly around it. But, yeah, man, if you come back to Australia, maybe we have to do that together.
yeah, for sure. For sure.
So, what were you studying in Australia and what was it like to study here?
I was doing aviation management. And the question about what's it like to study in Australia, I'd say it is expensive.
Well, especially if I think we had this chat, especially if you're studying anything in the realm of aviation.
Yeah, I think if you're studying anything in the realm of aviation, it really blows it up. But mm-hmm. I think in general, like education in Australia is expensive. It's not as bad as the United States.
Oh, man. Especially not for the locals, right? So, for me, when I went through, it was effectively free, but I had to get a loan from the government that I only then have to pay back once I make a certain level of income. And they'll only take a certain part off. But if you're a foreign student, then you've got to pay full fee up front. In America, yeah, they have the massive, you get a loan, but it's usually like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for a 4-year degree. And so it's like a house. Screwed up. I did an undergrad for 4 years, a master's degree for 2 years, and then my PhD, which was six years, and all up for the entire thing. I don't think I actually had to pay anything for the PhD, but for my entire education, it was $36,000 at university. That was it, you know. And
but wait, is that what you owe as your loan payback?
Yeah, that's all I owe. So it's the total that I mean, it's less than that because I've been paying it off. But I think when I remember looking it up after I finished my master's degree. For the subjects, because each subject you had to pay for effectively, and it was like, you know, $800, $1,000. But for the entire, I guess that would have been 6 years worth of, you know, 8 subjects a year, it was $36,000 for me. And I remember being astonished. I was expecting when I opened up, the government website being like, I'm going to get slapped with something huge. But then saw that and was like, oh my gosh, whoa, privilege, like lucky to be Australian.
Yeah. So, but I think even for international students, the reason why my dad and I chose Australia was because it was way more affordable than the other choices we had to do a degree in English. So in that sense, it is affordable, but I think, you know, being a high school student, having no responsibility whatsoever, living with my parents, you know, up until 18, and then suddenly having to, you know, manage my own finances, manage my own bills, my rent, and have the freedom to do whatever I want, is I think like a big change to have to adjust to.
It's a shock to the system. And I can't imagine doing that in a foreign country, let alone like I obviously went through the same thing of turning 18, finishing high school, and then suddenly moving 100 kilometers away from my parents and getting however much money it was just injected into my bank account on a monthly basis to pay for rent, to pay for food, to pay for transport, you know, everything like that. But no longer having anyone else that was responsible for it, right? No one else gave a shit. It was you and you alone. And if you spent all your money on booze and pizza, you had to wait a month or get a job, right? So, yeah, it was a big shock to the system. So, you went through the same thing, except you were in a foreign country as well, right?
Yeah. And, I mean, fortunately, I wasn't that crazy with like, partying and you know, spending my money irresponsibly or recklessly. But I think, like, the way it worked is whenever I needed money, I would just have to call my dad and tell him how much. Mm-hmm. And as long as the amount was reasonable, like it made sense, like I wasn't asking for like, you know, hundreds of thousands every week.
That's it. I just need to get my new Ferrari. The old one crashed.
And he was really generous. So he would just be like, yeah, okay, you know, I'll send it off today and you'll receive it in a week or something. And at the same, you know, still, I just felt guilty asking my dad for the amount of money I actually needed to cover my bills and to pay my tuition. It just didn't, like, to me, I felt like, why does it cost so much for just rent and food. Like, how does this even make sense? Mm-hmm. Because the cost of living in Brunei compared to Australia is so much more affordable. So
I had that shock in reverse when I went to Indonesia to do field work for about 2 months. And I remember it was so funny getting off the plane and you know, you want to go and buy something to drink or something to eat. And the weird thing in Indonesia was that it's kind of like the society is separated by class. And so you would be able to find malls that you could go into and there would be Starbucks and it would be the same price as Australia. And you'd be like, wait, what? But then the moment you would go outside and buy street food or anything, it would be like a tenth the price that you have just inside that mall. So, seeing those next to one another was really weird because you were kind of like, oh, shit, there's a whole group of people in society here that just never go into that building because they that's a day's pay would be their coffee.
Yeah. You know?
And then there's another group that just never talk to or have anything to do with the people outside that sort of building on the street. It was very weird getting used to that. But I remember, buying street food and getting used to getting a bit of money out of the ATM, you know, the equivalent of $10 Australian, and it would be many notes and it would last you a day or two. And then coming home, and I remember going to the supermarket and being like, what the fuck? $50? $50? Like, you know, that would have been like a week's worth of food. This is, you know, I bought some milk and chips. What the hell?
Yeah. I mean, that said, though, I think because Australia has such a strong agriculture industry, like my mom came with me when, and she was with me for a week in Australia, just helping me get settled in and stuff. You know, we went to the grocery store and my mom was like a kid in a candy store because she's super thrifty and she was the kind of mom who would like save every little penny. Like she would have this list of probably three different grocery stores that we would shop at. And there'd be a different day of the week we would go to each one.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like, when I'd go with her, I'd be like, hey, mom, you know, we're going to be out of milk soon. Should I get some milk? And be like, no, we're not going to buy milk at this store because tomorrow we're going to that other store where it's 2 cents cheaper. And I'm like, it's 2 cents cheaper? She goes, yep, because we're going to save every penny wherever we can. And she was so excited. Like I kid you not, she actually bought, I think it was cauliflower and a bunch of other vegetables and fruit. And she packed it into her luggage and carried it back to Brunei. Like that's.
Saving that for later. We're not throwing this out.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's true. Like, it's nuts how cheap, you know, fruits and vegetables and even meat, you can get. Beef for as little as $10 a kilo in Australia, that is unheard of here in Japan or, you know, in many other parts of the world.
Really? So, because, that's always one of those things. I obviously, since I got back from Indonesia, I haven't really left the country to go to any other foreign countries and I've become used to things again. But it is interesting. You go to the supermarket and sometimes you'll see prices on things and you'd be like, geez, this is so expensive. But you have no sort of relative understanding of what it's like in other countries, whether it's cheaper there or more expensive there.
Yeah. I mean, I think definitely for beef, I mean, beef is like this luxury, like out of all the different common meats, like if it's beef, chicken, pork, and even lamb, like beef and lamb would be like on right up on that hierarchy of luxury treats that you have once a year or something for when it's your birthday and there's a rainbow outside at the same time.
Was this in Brunei or in Japan?
I think, I'd say both. Think about Brunei's got this interesting thing because the Sultan of Brunei actually owns a cattle farm somewhere in the northwest of Australia. So it's this huge plot of land that's probably bigger than Brunei itself.
Well, he's one of the richest guys in the world, isn't he?
He's one of them. He used to be the richest guy in the world.
That's it. I remember that. You'd always be like, oh, the Sultan of Brunei. What's he worth currently? Hold on. Let me have a look. $28 billion. Jesus.
Sounds about right.
Okay. So, about what? What's that? Maybe a fifth about a fifth of what Bezos is worth from Amazon. So, not bad. Yeah, he's doing pretty well. just cattle, you reckon? That's what he's been selling, huh?
It's oil.
Of course,
it's Brunei Shell. Shell is the only oil and petroleum brand in Brunei, and that's owned and run by the royal family or by the Sultan, really.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, like just for, in order to get beef for the general public in Brunei at an affordable price, he owns a cattle farm in Australia where, you know, beef is farmed. Mm-hmm. And all of that is for consumption in Brunei.
Wow. Okay.
And it's, you know, we just wouldn't have, beef as affordably in Brunei if it wasn't for that.
Because of the land and everything, obviously. You just wouldn't have the amount of space to do it. Or you'd have to import it from somewhere else.
Exactly. And if you're going to import it, it's going to cost you whatever it does to properly import it, you know, pay the margins, pay the tax and all of that stuff. Right. Whereas because it's the Brunei government basically that's importing it, you're not paying all that extra stuff.
Wow. So did you have any other sort of culture shock things whilst you were here in Australia that you sort of were like, whoa, that's way too expensive, or oh my God, you can do that here, or?
I think probably the biggest culture shock was how casual and informal people can be.
Yeah.
Even if they're meeting you for the first time.
This would be an interesting point to transition between Japan and Australia, I think, because I have a feeling from my limited experience learning about Japan that it is the very inverse of what Australia is. So, can you tell us a bit about that, getting used to the informality of Australia, and then maybe we can transition over to Japan. We'll go for a jump over the pond. And
yeah, I got to say, I loved that about Australia. You know, I remember going to my university lectures and like the lecturers would literally be just talking to us like we were sitting around a coffee table and having a chat or having a coffee, you know. And they were just that approachable. You could call your lecturers by their first names.
100%.
Not could, but they'd probably not like you very much if you called them anything else.
Oh, yeah, man. That was my experience. They would always be like, Jesus, don't call me Mr. or Professor so-and-so or Dr. so-and-so, you know, unless it was in a very formal situation where you were, say, introducing them, you know, you wouldn't be like, oh, here's Kath. She's coming up on the stage to give a speech. You'd be like, oh, this is Dr. Handaside. She's coming up to talk about so-and-so. But yeah, it would be one of those things where it makes us feel uncomfortable when you use those sorts of epithets before our names, because it's almost as if you see us higher than you, and we find that very uncomfortable. We want to be seen as equal, you know, we're on the same level, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's something that I carry with me to this day. Like, I personally don't feel comfortable being called Mr. Rajaraman or my students used to call me Teacher David here in Japan. And that's the direct translation of David Sensei. For me, it's just weird. Cause again, for me, the feeling is I want to be an equal. I don't want to be seen as superior to you. I am fallible. I can make mistakes even as a teacher. And I want to be treated and addressed that way. And it happens on social media as well. People be like, Teacher David. I'm not Teacher David. I'm David.
I've had it with quite a few Iranians. They'll call me Dear Peter, Teacher Peter. I've had Master Peter, and I was like, that makes me feel uncomfortable. Good God.
Yeah.
Don't call me Master. Yeah. You're not my slave. So did you slide into the informality, the cultural informality in Australia pretty quickly, and you got used to it, and you felt, oh my God, I can adopt this, and this is part of my personality and my identity now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's, Brunei as well, it's like the Malay version of that. I think in Brunei, people are pretty informal as well. And it's just that we're using the Malay language when we meet for the first time and stuff. So I was able to adjust to that pretty easily. And also just the fact that I had, teachers from Australia when I was in high school and stuff. I think that kind of primed me and got me ready for that. It wasn't too much of a shock. Like off the top of my head, I can't think of much that really was a culture shock. I think I just kind of found a lot of it, easy to accept. Like probably the biggest departure from Brunei culture was the role of alcohol in society in Australia.
Brunei is a Muslim country?
Yeah, Brunei is a Muslim country, and alcohol, the sale and purchase of alcohol was outlawed in like the late 80s or early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was like around about when I was 3 or 4 years old. So late 80s. And probably like a couple of years after I moved to Australia, the same thing happened with tobacco.
Oh,
so
wow.
you could only buy it from outside the country, bring it in limited quantities for personal consumption, and you could only smoke within closed doors on your own premises or like you're in your own home. So, you know, over in Australia, everybody drinks, and it's like, and I've tried beer. I can't stand the taste or smell of it.
Yeah, it was something I didn't drink until I was probably 23. Like, legally, I was allowed to at 18. And most boys tend to start a lot earlier than that.
Yeah.
And they tend to start with something like beer because it's macho and, you know, manly. But I was always worried about just getting drunk because I saw a lot of my mates acting like dickheads and was just like, I'm a dickhead as it is. I don't need to drink anything to make this worse. Yeah. I was worried about that. But I remember when I first started, it was I just hated, I would have mixed drinks because I hated beer. I hated wine. I hated spirits. I just wanted to effectively drink something like Coke and have alcohol in it. And then it's sort of this transition, right, away from all the sweet things, and then eventually you get into ciders and the sweeter dessert wines, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I want something bitter, more bitter, you know? So, I finally got into beers probably in my late 20s, and now it's just like, oh, wow, yeah. But it's a take it or leave it thing. I don't really... Yeah, it is interesting. I always wonder what people from countries where these things are outlawed think it's like when they're legal. Because, you know, where you would imagine, oh, my gosh, like in America with the drugs that are outlawed, right? You can't do heroin. You can't buy heroin. You can't buy cocaine. And people always think, oh, man, if these things are legal tomorrow, people are just going to go nuts. Everyone's going to become a heroin addict. They're going to be on the streets dying. But then, say, with like cannabis, when they show that they've, you know, legalized that in a lot of places in the US, the consumption is actually not. It doesn't go out of control. And the people who smoke or buy it are the people who are doing so beforehand, not necessarily just mum and dad who are like, finally, it's legal. Let's do it.
Yeah. You know what? Now that you bring that up, I think there might be a bit of a relationship between if you're already doing or consuming that substance before it's legalized. Because I think if you're already doing it and you're not abusing it to begin with, then... Yeah. Once it gets legalized, there's going to be no difference to you whatsoever. It's just probably going to be more accessible, right?
Well, the difference is finally I know that the quality is good quality and it's safe for my consumption as opposed to just buying it from some dude in a dark cloak in an alley somewhere who's just like, yeah, trust me, it's fine.
Yeah. But here's what I saw with some of my friends who are from other Muslim countries, some of them from Brunei. They get to Australia. Their whole lives, they've been told that alcohol is the devil.
Yeah.
And like for the first time, they actually get to try it. They go nuts and they go out of control.
Really? I was like expecting the opposite where they'd be like, this isn't that good. Boring.
No, they are literally out drinking, getting smashed.
Jeez.
Getting smashed, which is like this term that you get here. You hear a lot in Australia.
To get drunk.
They were getting, you know, drunk off their faces almost every weekend. Like at best, it would be every weekend. At worst, it would be every night.
Good God.
And I just couldn't believe it. I'll be like, even some of my old friends from Brunei, I'd be like, hey, weren't these, this was the same guy who was super pious.
And I'd be thinking, what, did you just turn 18? Like most Australians who are children or, you know, teenagers probably act like this for a number of weeks. I don't know if you can't really maintain it much longer than that. But it tends to wear out pretty quickly. So, it would be weird to see grown adults come to Australia and then just be like, it's on. And it sounds like the that sort of, what would you call it? The story of like the pastor's daughter who ends up being, you know, promiscuous. So, she's been grown up. She's grown up her whole life with this, you know, heavily religious parent or parents who've said, you can't be with boys, you can't talk to boys, you can't hold hands with boys. And then she ends up, you know, incredibly promiscuous later on in life because she's been denied that her entire lifetime. And it's funny when there's kind of like those two extremes. And I always worry about this with my kids. I'm like, what am I going to have to be self-conscious of and aware of, like not being overly protective for the sake of in the long run, they don't go nuts with, say, you know, drug use where you teach them, all drugs are bad no matter what, except have these legal ones. So never use this, blah, 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 blah. And then they turn 18 and just go berserk. Or, yeah. You know, with sex, you never talk about sex. And then all of a sudden they work it out and they're like, oh my God, I found this secret thing that no one's ever told me about. And then they go bananas. So it is interesting how some people just do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I at the same time, like I've had some of my friends grow up with super strict parents and they grew up fine. Like they weren't, You know, they never turned, they never went crazy wild once they finally got their freedom. So I don't know. I think I've heard parents say that like every kid is different and like, you know, friends of mine who have like, let's say two or three kids and I've sat down and talked to them sometimes. I'd be like, do you treat each of your kids differently because you know that they're different and they respond to different things? And be like, yeah, of course. Mm. And, they'll be like, I would, in this sort of a situation, I'd treat my son like this, but my older son, it'd be totally different. Like, okay. Yeah.
It was interesting growing up with my parents. They were pretty open about these sorts of things and always comfortable talking about whatever. They wouldn't necessarily be like, yeah, go out there and do some heroin. It'll be great. You know, but it would be much more about informed decision making. So they would be like, ultimately, we're not you. You have to decide what you're going to do with your life. You're going to do drugs. Yeah. If you're not going to do drugs, if you're going to, you know, go to university, whatever you want to do, you're going to have to do. But just make those decisions based on information that you have thought about and considered prior to making those decisions. Don't just run into things and, you know, oh, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah. That, I think, my mom, for example, she was super strongly against alcohol, like at all. There's no such thing as having a wine with a meal. Like that is even equivalent to getting drunk and beating your wife.
Jesus, that's one of those things that you just look at, you know, for me, and it's like one of those is so normalized, and I can't imagine ever normalizing. Yeah, he's just beating his wife. You know, what do you mean? You just do that, right? Like I can't. Yeah, it's so funny that you would see it, because I've obviously grown up in this culture, and it's just part of my life. We had the same sort of experience when I went to France in year 11. So, I would have been 16. In France, it blew our mind because here in Australia, alcohol, you can buy alcohol, but you have to be of age. You have to be 18. You have to have identification. And typically, because of this, you end up with children, well, teenagers that are, once they get to like 15, 16, 17, start experimenting with alcohol. Like someone will buy it for them. They'll go to a party and there'll be older people there drinking and they'll sneak some. And so, it's pretty common for teenagers to get drunk and, you know, throw up and, you know, have these sorts of events. Not a lot, but it happens. And I remember going to France and none of the teenagers behaved like that there. And because they had grown up with parents who were like, oh, you're 14. Do you want a little bit of wine with dinner? You know, so it was just not a big deal. And I remember one of the girls when we were on this trip went into a store and just came out with a bottle of vodka. And I was like,
whoa,
you know. You know, so-and-so, how on earth did you get that? You're 16. And she was just like, they don't ask for ID. They don't care. And then I remember she ended up having, you know, all of the guys and her mates and everything in the room, you know, smashing this vodka one night. And the next morning, everyone was like, all the kids, we were trying to go through Notre Dame or whatever. And they're all like vomiting in the streets of Paris. And the teacher being like, oh, it looks like everyone got like a flu or something or the stomach bug. And I was like, yeah, it's not that. But it was interesting because the French kids were like, what the hell is wrong with these people? Like, it's like you've never had alcohol before. And the Australians were like, what the hell is wrong with these French kids? It's like they don't realize they can buy all this alcohol from the store. All right. So, that was an interesting sort of segue to moving to Japan. Yeah. How did you end up doing that? And what was that process like?
Process was pretty simple. It was simple for me because I was in my last semester in Australia. And I started applying for jobs because, I was going to be graduating with my aviation degree. So I was literally sending out at least maybe 10 applications a day to all sorts of places, airlines, airports, small flight schools. And this is in various different countries. I didn't hear back from any of them. Like absolutely none. And at around about that time, I met this friend who suggested that maybe I consider teaching English in Japan. And I didn't even know that such an industry existed. I didn't know it was a big deal. And then I thought, yeah, you know, what the heck, you know, if they'll pay for my visa and, you know, and pay me enough to survive, then yeah, maybe I'll consider it. So I applied to a few of these, like big, they're called Eikaiwas, like English conversation schools. And actually, no, you know what? I didn't apply to a few of them. I shortlisted a few and I just applied to one.
Yep.
And this particular one was one of the big ones. And they actually had their interviews in, Australia, the UK, the US and the UK, basically the countries where they recruited teachers from.
Yep.
So when I looked at their calendar, they actually had an interview, coming up pretty soon in Sydney. And so I applied. I got called in for the interview. I went for it and I did well enough that they decided to hire me.
Did you need prior experience, or it was just, you just show up and they're like, well, speaks English, let's do it.
Basically, yeah, the only like hard requirements would be you need to speak English, like well enough, like on a first language level, basically. And you need to have a university degree in anything. And okay. I think even the university degree is not necessary. It's just so they can sponsor your visa.
Okay.
And that was it. Like, so I was graduating in a few months. So the degree, I checked that box. And then with the English, it was my first language. So I was able to do that as well. And I think the other thing they look for is like the general stuff. Like, is this person, does this person carry themselves professionally? Do they dress well? Do they speak politely and that sort of thing? But
does he drink so too much?
Yeah. Like I didn't pick my nose during the interview, so I got a pass on that. So
they told you that at the end, did they? So they were like, oh man, yeah. you did everything right. And fortunately you didn't pick your nose. So you were hired.
Like those other guys did. You know,
so. Yeah. So what happened? They hired you and then you just were like, well, all right, start work next week. Let's do this.
Yeah. I was basically, yeah, like, let's do this. And, this was in May, around about May. And I graduated in July. So between then and when I actually, moved to Japan, there were just like a number of phone calls for them to find a vacancy. Cause they got like, I think it's over 200 schools across the country.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Or probably more than that. They're in all the major cities. And there was a recruiter at their main recruiting office in LA that I was, in correspondence with. So I think it took a few months for them to like look at my profile and kind of find a school and location that would be right for me. I'm not sure if that's actually true. That's what they said. And I think it's just like you get put on a waiting list. And as soon as a vacancy comes up, they're just like, here you go. Let's mm-hmm. put in there.
We've specially selected this one place for you, which is the only place we need someone right now.
Yeah. And so the vacancy was in December. So. I was swapping with a teacher who was leaving around about that time. And this is in a city called Wakayama. Mm-hmm. It's about a 1 hour train ride south of Osaka. And it was in December. Yeah. So it was between May and December. I was in India for a little bit. I was in Singapore with my brother for a little bit, just kind of waiting to figure out where I was going to go. And in December, packed my bags and went to Japan.
So, what was that process like? I've read a book called Rule Makers, Rule Breakers. I've got it up here so I can remember. It's by Michelle Gelfand. Do you know that one?
No, I haven't heard of it. What's it about?
Tight and loose cultures and the secret signals that direct our lives. So, effectively, I've heard her interview quite a few times as well on these topics, and it's really interesting because cultures tend to be on this continuum between being very tight. Like Japan, where, you know, you have these very sort of strict social rules. We do this, we don't do that. And then loose cultures like Australia, where things are a lot more relaxed and informal at times. Yeah. And so sort of all countries kind of fall along this continuum somewhere. So you've obviously gone from Brunei, which I imagine in my mind is a bit of a tight culture, being an Islamic country, coming to Australia, yeah. which is a very loose culture, and then going to Japan, which is a tight culture again, but obviously a little bit different from Brunei. What was the experience like, obviously, after adapting to life in Australia and getting used to the culture and the sort of looseness of society, and then moving to Japan where things are so different? And it's a completely different language, one of the hardest languages for English speakers to learn.
Yeah. I think I didn't really know what to expect because it was my first job. And I kind of got a little bit of a brief before going there. They told me that I would be spending a week in training and then get put out, you know, with some other new recruits. And then I'd move out to the actual school that I'm working at. That week of training was intense. It was like full working days. And if you think about them trying to train you to teach English lessons, and they're trying to train people who have no experience doing this whatsoever.
In a week.
They're trying to get you ready to go into their schools and basically start teaching lessons from their textbooks and curriculum.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that a lot of this was exactly the same as how they do everything else in Japan. But what was kind of weird for me was it was so precise and scripted. Like, they expected the lessons to be scripted.
Yeah.
And so they would train us on like the flow of the lessons, how many minutes are meant to be spent on each section of the lesson. And the one thing that I wasn't used to at that point was keeping track of time to like in units of that are not five. So like typically, right, if you're going to plan something, you would say, I'm going to spend 5 minutes on this, 10 minutes on that, 15 on something. So you'd count in kind of lots of five, right?
Mm-hmm.
But with this, they were like, okay, we're going to spend 2 minutes on warm up. We're going to spend 3 minutes on the first exercise, 7 on the next, 6 on the following one, and 13 on the final like conversation. I was like, who is coming up with these numbers?
That would be my question. I'm like, did you guys do empirical studies to work out that this is the most effective way, or did you just pull these out of your bum? Like, are these just pulled out of thin air, or how did you decide this?
And true enough to the stereotype, the Japanese are extremely religious about keeping time and about punctuality. It's and they expected that of us in training. They did tell us that, like, when you actually get to schools, you can deviate from this. But here in training, where you've got perfect students, we expect you to be pretty close to those time markers.
Wow.
Surely
that was a lot of stress.
Yeah, it was. And we'd have to plan out our lesson plans. And in our lesson plans on this A3 piece of paper, they had like little squares for each section of the lesson. They expected us to write out word for word what we were going to say.
Jesus.
Like, including, and next we're going to turn to page 34. And like, you would have to write that out word for word and submit that the next day to our trainers. And then they'd be like, they'd have that with them as they're watching you deliver your demo lesson.
Holy moly. I can't imagine doing that. That sounds like a nightmare, like, just for me personally, because even my videos where I create content, even the podcasts, it's dot points. And then I'm just speaking. I'm just free flowing. It's very informal. I'm just enjoying the process. I can't imagine like reading off a teleprompter and needing to be that precise. It would just stress me out so much.
Yeah. But it was stressful. Fortunately, the trainers themselves, they were super nice, very supportive, very, very friendly, approachable. And it like training itself was intense. It was hard work, but it was fun at the same time, in that, you know, I got to build relationship with these other teachers as well, who all felt like I did because they were new. They were in Japan for the first time. And we got to explore a little bit on our days off. And, you know, when I got to school, I didn't feel ready at all. But again, the staff at the school, the other teachers I was working with, they were all really supportive and welcoming. But, you know, it was later on, spending a little bit more time in Japan, I realized that, you know, this is actually part of their culture. Like, they script everything. They're meticulous about how everything needs to be done methodically. And for me, my perspective on doing any task is you have an outcome, and that outcome is the objective. If there's any, it doesn't really matter how you get to that outcome. If you can get to that outcome by a method that gives you the desired efficiency and productivity, then that's mission accomplished. But in my observation of Japanese culture is, regardless of the outcome, the method matters. The method for everything is prescribed, and you are supposed to follow that method. Yeah. Even if you get the same outcome, but you made a mistake on the method, you will be, for lack of a better term, at least told off for it.
It is such a peculiar culture from our point of view, I think, and they must see us equally as strangely, right? You would imagine the Japanese see the West as sort of like this. Well, what do you mean? You can just not follow the rules or not, not just do this, you know, this set of methods that you have to do to get the thing. I remember, I think we were chatting about hierarchies at workplaces, right? And how important, you were telling me, the positions are for each of the managers and everything and how they see themselves, and also that you must do what you're expected to do, right? The way you're expected to do it below each person. And if you don't, even if you succeed, you've effectively failed, right?
Yeah. I think that, along with the whole, paying attention to how something is done and that mattering as much as it does, I think what would shock a lot of people in Japan as well is looking at other parts of the world and be thinking, how can you not have a prescribed plan and strategy for everything you do?
How do these guys accomplish anything?
what improvisation? What the hell is that?
Yeah.
And true enough, when you watch TV here, even reality shows or things that are supposed to be off the cuff, they're actually not off the cuff.
Yeah.
It's so clear that they are scripted, and that, how do I put it? There's a lack of authenticity in Japanese reality TV, even though reality TV in general is scripted, but it's not to the extent that it is here.
What are the ways that, I guess what I wanted to cover here is that I find a lot of the students who talk to me about wanting to develop confidence when speaking, you know, I'm afraid to speak, I don't want to make mistakes. By and large, they tend to be of Asian origin. They tend to be from countries like China or Japan, where I feel like they're a lot more, they're tighter cultures. They, like you say, they have a certain method to doing something. And so, when they go to classes for English, they're so used to sort of being spoon-fed, do this, do this, do this, and then remember all these things, go to the exam, answer the questions, and then you can speak English. But then when they get off the plane, once they've arrived in Australia, they realize that, you know, interacting with people in the real world isn't like in a classroom where you can just, you know, use lines that you've practiced and memorized. It's actually improvising, like conversations, like the conversation you're having with me now is all 100% improvised. So, I guess my point here is, what sort of advice do you have as someone who's taught students in Japan who have come from this background of being, you know, they've been raised with this sort of system, that then when they get into the real life, say they've come to Australia and they're at university and they're studying, it hasn't set them up to thrive, and they kind of have to unlearn that system. What's the kind of advice that you would give them for doing well and being able to start speaking with confidence?
It's not profound advice, and it's probably not going to be as easy as it sounds, but it's to stop caring. I understand, you know, having been here, how much pressure they can be there can be about when it comes to not making a mistake. And mistakes here, even if it's a small one, are taken seriously. Every mistake is taken seriously and is, and there can be, in my opinion, I think, an overreaction when someone is being disciplined for even a tiny little slip up. And I think, and even with English, the way it's taught here, it's mainly just a subject in school, right? You're preparing to take an exam, and it's all about writing the correct answer. And if you don't put in that blank, if you don't write on that piece of paper the prescribed expression or phrase, even if it's like one word off, you'll lose marks. Mm-hmm. If you write something that is grammatically correct, I actually heard about this happening to the daughter of a foreign, an English teacher here in Japan. So it's her first language. She speaks English, right? Yeah. So the level of English that she's being taught at school is super easy.
Yeah.
On an English test, she wrote an answer which is perfectly correct. If anything, it is more correct and more natural than what the actual prescribed answer was. She got marked down for it. And that's the only reason why she didn't get a perfect score, I can't remember what the actual sentence was, but it was something ridiculous.
It wasn't what they were looking for.
It wasn't what they wanted, and she didn't get the marks for it, even though it was actually correct. And that's what they're brought up with. So I understand that when they get put in a real conversation situation, the first thought that comes to mind is, don't make a mistake.
Yeah.
I need to say what the correct expression is in order to communicate. And I'd say just stop thinking that way. That's not the case.
Well, it's communication over perfection, right? Ultimately, yeah. You know, if I'm in Melbourne and I come across someone from Japan and I want to talk to them, or I'm meeting them for the first time, or I'm going on a date with them, I don't give a shit about mistakes that they make. I want to be able to communicate with them. I want to be able to talk to them. And if they make grammatical errors or they use the wrong vocab, if I can understand them, that's a win. That's where you're correct, right? Like, as long as I can understand you and we can communicate, you've won. That's it. That's the goal. Whereas I'm not going to remember if you make a mistake, and I'm not going to remember if you get everything right. I've met plenty of English students, and I've never come home and said to my wife, man, this guy today just made no grammatical errors. I was talking to him the whole time and he didn't make any mistakes. And equally, I've never come home and said, man, I was talking to this one guy and he made this one mistake. And I was like, what a fucking idiot. Like, that guy's so dumb. No one ever does that. No one ever does that, ever. Like, so 100%. That is what I would be telling them too. It's just, you have to sort of relax. Remember, it's about communication, and don't stress out. It's not worth the worry. It's not worth the stress. And no one, you're putting it on yourself. No one else is expecting you to be perfect.
I will add one thing, though. I think, if anything, by being too cautious, by just kind of freezing up and making the other person wait till you get your thoughts out, can probably frustrate them more than you just trying to communicate and perhaps making a few mistakes, but still getting your message across.
Well, it's a hindrance, right? You're hindering the communication process by actually overthinking it.
Yep.
It's almost like, you know, you're at your kids at the pool, and one of them gets to the top of the diving board and the other kids are all lined up and they're like, just go, just dive, just stop thinking about it. Just do it.
It's okay if you belly flop.
I know. Just do it. Right? And they're just like, let me get down. I want to get down. So, all right, finishing up, what were the really positive things that you learned about Japan that you really loved? Are there things that are obviously very different there from Australia that you were like, man, Australia could totally benefit from taking these things up, you know, food or cultural practices?
I would say safety is like the number one thing that I love about Japan. You can lose your wallet, lose your phone, your valuables, you can drop it somewhere, and you will more likely get it back intact than for it to disappear forever.
Wow.
And in Australia, that doesn't happen. I mean, yeah, people are, you know, honest and they care, they have integrity to, for the most part. But if you drop your phone somewhere, you're not getting that back. Right?
That's going to fall into someone's hands through the line somewhere. Even if someone does say, oh man, I'm going to make sure this gets back to the person, it's going to get to someone's hands who's either going to be like, keeping it, or I can't be bothered dealing with this, and just throw it away.
Yeah. Or even if you drop your wallet, if you do get it back, it's going to be empty. Right?
Whoa, what are you trying to say, dude?
No, but that's not to say that that's something about Australia, but that's anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Right?
Pretty much.
But here in Japan, it's just not like that at all. Well, people will...
It's the good side of the honor culture, right? Of where it says something very positive about you culturally, that you see yourself as, you know, you do the right thing no matter what. It can be very uncomfortable, but you do the right thing. And Australia has that to some degree, but there's also the... Yeah, she'll be right. I can't be bothered.
Yeah. So, I'd say that's the number one thing I love about Japan. It's that, and it's just how safe it is. You can actually go out at night, go through the dark alleyways, like the shady parts of town, and not get stabbed or not get into a fight, not have a beer glass broken over your head, you know, for no reason. The worst thing that, like, I've literally had this conversation with some of my students. Like, I'd talk to them about this some part of town, and they'd be like, oh, you shouldn't go there late at night. It's dangerous. Like, they literally use the word dangerous.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, oh, what could happen? It'd be like, some, like, random person might talk to you.
One time, this one person lost their wallet and never got it back.
Yeah. No, but even that wouldn't happen. Like, if you did drop your wallet there, you would actually still get it back, you know.
I wonder if people have done studies on that. There must be studies where they've literally gotten, you know, 50 wallets, they put money in it, and then they just drop them in different cultures around the world and then see how many of these get returned.
Yeah, that would be an interesting study. I'd love to see what happens.
Yeah. It is funny to sort of finish up here that I did a video on culture shock in Australia, and one of the points that I made in this video was that you could walk around at night and it's really safe. And I remember the amount of backlash that I got from Australian women in particular, who, you know, rightly would say, well, you're a man, you know, so you don't have to worry like we have to worry if we're going out at night, which, you know, is a fair point. But then it was really interesting to hear from all of the foreigners who were like, what are you smoking? He's dead on. Have you been to Brazil? Like, you can't just walk. It doesn't matter who you are. You can't just walk around at nighttime, you know, in a park. What are you smoking? Whereas in Australia, you can do that. And yeah, people have been murdered and you know, horrible things have happened, but it's not like that's happening on a daily basis. And so, it is really funny that it's kind of like when you're in the country, you see the culture is much more dangerous than objectively it is. And other people who come to the country like Australia see it as the opposite sort of thing. So, it is really funny where two people are looking at the same thing, but they're seeing different things, right? It's like that dress online or whatever. Is it blue and yellow or white and black or, you know, that optical illusion?
Yep.
So, yeah, it is interesting. One last question. What was it like learning Japanese? Because that sounds like it would have been quite a task.
Yeah, it's tough, man. Like, the thing is, I haven't really applied myself. I should have over the years. For me, I just learned it through conversing with people here, and I had to. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to get through my daily tasks, and I wouldn't have any friends. So, and I found that pretty easy to get my head around the grammar, because it's so similar to Tamil. So there's a whole bunch of times where I've been unable to directly translate something word for word from between Japanese and English, but I am able to do that between Japanese and Tamil. Like, the word order is the same.
It's funny how your brain obviously finds shortcuts and just says, man, okay, well, Tamil's like this, boom, that's similar to Japanese, so I'll just go that route.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that I actually translate in my head. I don't. I am able to think in Japanese, and I reached that level, I think, in about a year to 2 years, somewhere around that range. But the hardest thing about it is the reading and writing, because they use the Chinese characters. Every word has its own character. So, you can't just sound something off and read it. If you've never learned that word, you see it, you're not even going to be able to look it up, because you can't pronounce it in the first place.
You're fucked.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I always wondered that with languages that use characters, you know, what is the equivalent of a spelling mistake? And yeah, you can't sound out these sorts of words, right? So, a spelling mistake, I imagine, would be that you use a wrong stroke or something and it means something else, or it doesn't mean, you know, it is the same thing, but it's just not 100% correct. Whereas in English, obviously, you can, spelling mistakes aren't that you just write a different line on the paper, you'll use the wrong letter or you'll add in letters when they shouldn't be and everything. And one of the funny things about English is I didn't appreciate this until I started speaking English. I wonder how much we, as a language, because we're not phonetic, at least most of the time, have much more trouble with spelling, especially too because of, on top of that, we have the schwa, right? So, you have these words with emphasis on different syllables, and the syllables without the emphasis where it's reduced and there's a schwa can have effectively any vowel sound or combination of vowels that are just sort of disappeared. And so, I wondered how much... I remember thinking I was so dumb in school because I was always making, you know, independent. Does it end with an E-N-T or an A-N-T? You know, that sort of thing where you would just be like, oh, my God. Like, how do I not know this? And it's because it's a freaking schwa. So, it just always blew my mind. But, yeah, in Japanese, obviously, you don't have that, right? If you're using the- is it the kanji? Not the characters, but the other-
the phonetic script?
Yeah, because that's 100% phonetic, right? So, they just- There's no way you would ever make mistakes, I imagine.
Correct. Yeah. Like, because they are phonetic. So, that does make it a lot easier. But it's so rarely used. Like, most things you write would have to be written in kanji anyway.
Like, is it just shorter? So, it's easier to do that, is it?
It's easier to do that. It's the correct way. And we talked about how like the method is important.
Yeah.
I mean, you could, if you wanted to, write everything in hiragana, which is the phonetic script. It wouldn't be seen as professional. Your work of writing wouldn't be acceptable in an academic context and that sort of thing.
Man, imagine if you tried to learn Mandarin Chinese now, because I know that the characters... Well, actually, it would probably have to be Cantonese because they use the classical Chinese characters. And I know that Japanese got it from them. But imagine that mind-bending having to yeah. I imagine a lot of the characters are the same, but I can imagine there are very many exceptions.
Yeah. I can't imagine having to learn Chinese. But I think eventually when I get my head around kanji, which I have to over the next few years, because I'm working at this as a car mechanic now, and I'm in training. I'm an apprentice, so I'll have to take some written exams to get my license.
Yeah,
and so I'm trying right now to learn the written kanji, or learn to write kanji, because I'll have to write like paragraphs on the exam. When I get my head around that, I might actually try my hand at Chinese.
Just a glutton for punishment, dude. Far out. Well, David, I've kept you for over an hour. Where can people find out more about you and, you know, follow you? Because I assume you're still teaching English online, or you've sort of gone off that now because you're a mechanic?
No, I am. I do still teach English online. You can find out about me and all my social media stuff on speaklikedavid.com.
Yep. Brilliant. Too easy. He's just got a website. Go there, guys. Check him out and follow him on Instagram for sure. Well, David, thank you so much for joining me, and we'll have to have you on again. Cheers.
Hey, thank you for having me. Have a great day.